see, the thing about it, is I have lived with this so much, I thrive on it. It's not that I particularly love it, but I have just worked myself into the attitude, you see, that it is the one thing that's fruitful that I do. Now this thing here, and see, you don't have to worry. I'll carry it, and you can lean on me. I'm used to that. The only thing that bothers me is when they nip at my ankles like the little puppy dogs. I think that's so childish, you see. They nip at you. Now you see, last night when we talked to Jack, I had this letter to go by. Now, I don't know what happened, but all at once, you see, these things are right substantial. And he seems to sort of listen to what I say in my letters.
Yeah.
And for all this time we've been down here, you see, these letters have been as perfunctory, as empty, as any documents you ever saw from people who ought to know better. Now you say this first little go-round here, I told him about our car, and he said we finally got something to see that would hold us up. Keep us, to see, spare us from the mechanics, spare the mechanics from us. And he'd faced that problem long ago when he had a Toyota. He had two of them. Now, I don't know whether Jack's not giving overstatements or baiting people, but he says a tank of gas would keep one of those things going around on their errands for 6 weeks. And it's a small tank.
Yeah.
Now, he didn't get the point of that Odom thing, using solar energy that goes back to the time he lived in Florida, and so in South Florida, you see the heated water was the sun's heat. The point of it, as they were talking about it here, was what they call net energy. What he pointed out was we had all the sources of energy like shale, but it cost so much to get it out. By the time you got it out, it cost about as much as the energy was worth. You had to put, it took about as much energy to work the shale up as the shale would produce. So you were just given six for six.
That's what Anthony, David Anthony said. Why hadn't I thought of that?
Yeah. Why hadn't I thought of that? Well, now that'll get around. Now, then he picks me up on the I don't remember what I said about that, the mind fix. He says there are a good many kinds, and he picks it up in the way I haven't kept up with it. This rigid scholarism, you see, of the northeastern places school. And the posturing of the California colleagues, and then he doesn't feel too close to McConkie at Cornell. Now that's worth going into, Faye, and he'll go into that down here. But of course, he wasn't up there long enough to see what they did. He got that nice statement, you see. One of the advantages of the cultural lag of scholars in the South is that it allows them, as scholars, have been a benefit rather than an obstacle. Certainly, I think it's easier to live a reasonably contented and sane life in the South than it is in the Northeast.
Uh-huh.
It's this, they've got something between them and that rigid scholarism. Now that's his turn, not mine. Now he picked me up on the new post. He wasn't hard with me like Roscoe was. If he knows me at all, he'd know I'm not looking for a new post. I just merely said that it's a shame I didn't have a new post, couldn't get a new post now, when I had all these things to work out, and when I had a chance, I didn't have much to work out. That this little report then on how they're contracting up there, you see they're short of money, you see they don't have time or effort for any playing around. You'd be weighed down if you were up there. They give you something to do all the time, and the administration still asks for innovations, but if you suggest one, they expect the man who suggested to administer it and carry on his old load and at the same old salary. Uh-huh. He knows that only too well, you see. You see, that's, now, he has all that to report on. Now, if he came down here, you see, he just can't imagine, see, what has taken place down here. There's just no way of doing it. If you get into it little by little,
yeah,
in a week's time, you can do a vast amount.
Yeah.
With a fellow like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when you went up there, to see Smitty, you thought everything was fixed. JR had got a hold of the car when I was over there talking to him. When I caught him that day, out there in the sun, sitting on the tailgate of his that Ford pickup truck that he feels so close to, swinging his legs to get that needle working again. Then in the middle of it, I thought of it, and I said, "Jay, I've got something here that's just wobbling and shaking and shakes the steering wheel. It's so wobbly." I lifted the hood, and he looked at it and said, "That's your power steering." And he reached around there and tried to see what was loose. And he saw that bolt underneath it that held it onto a bracket. You see, the one nut was on this side and one was on the back. So he hobbled around and got him a couple of wrenches, one to put the back to hold the bolt, and one in the front there to tighten the nut on it. And later, he didn't tighten it all the way, he said. He didn't know how far it ought to be tightened, how tight it ought to be. He said it looked like it had been backed off. And I think it was, see, because you see, it was the nut was way out from the bracket. And even Smitty, you see, didn't propose loosening it up to where it would just wobble. But anyhow, when you got up there, when you went by to see Smitty,
Well, I thought it was all, it was all fixed. I remember you asked, well, why hadn't they tightened it when they looked at it over on the hill? And he said that it was because they didn't know to. So I figured that it was all right. And I was a little surprised when you said, when you said, you better go look at that, have Smitty listen to it. I thought that was a little odd.
Yes.
Because I thought it was all fixed. Well.
Well, when you got a chance to get Smitty to listen to your motor.
Yeah, you got to do it.
Yeah.
I called him on Monday, and he said, bring it in Wednesday early.
Bring it in early.
At noon. And I I was going to meet Debbie at 12, so I got into town, and I thought, well, I won't go by the house. I'll just go by the gas well.
Right
first
straight
thing.
By gas well.
So, well, when I went down the lane here, I heard this noise. And out on the highway, I heard it, and I thought, well, golly, maybe it did occur to me in the back of my mind, maybe J.I. has done something to this thing. I never heard it sound like this before. And I pulled up there at the gas well. First thing I saw was a big homemade sign out of gas, and the cars were just filled. I didn't even find a parking place. I couldn't see Smitty anywhere, and I looked back there, and there were two cars on the rack. No, one was on the rack, one was down.
Both racks had cars on them.
Yeah, and one was down below, and the hood was up, and I wandered around, and there was Smitty with his head on the hood. So I went right back there, stuck my head under the hood, and I said, am I too early? And he said, you know, like he does, he gave me that sidewise smile of his and looked, sort of twinkle.
Twisted his mouth
around to one side. He said, Uncle Johnny will take you home. Leave the car. Uncle Johnny will take you home. Well, you know, I knew I wasn't going to leave it because I wanted him to hear what I heard. So I just kept my head under the hood a minute. He went on working. I said, Miss Smitty, it wouldn't take you 2 seconds to listen to that thing. I said, you know, I don't trust anybody but you to listen. If you just listen to that thing, you could tell me whether what I need. Well, he took his head out from under the hood and wiped his hands on that old oily cloth and marched over to the car. He knew where it was. He'd seen me drive up.
Right, he's devil.
He doesn't miss a thing. He didn't even tell me to start the engine. He just raised the hood. And I didn't tell him it was the power steering. I just said they had a fellow out here tightened the rod and it made it. He said that was the trouble. So he just shook that power steering thing a little bit, and it shook. And then I said, well, this fellow out here in the country said it was too loose, so he tightened that rod down in there. And Smitty went around on the other side and looked at the rod. And he came back around and shook it again and didn't say a word about that. He just looked at me and he said, get in. And there was that whole lot full of cars. Oh, and another thing happened. When he raised the hood, two fellas came running out. Fellas I didn't know, I hadn't seen before, worked down there. They came out in a hurry. As if, you know, there's something real interesting going to happen. If Smitty was going to look at it, they wanted to learn. And when Smitty said, get in, well, they went on back to what they were doing. And we started on a ride. And I said, well, you better take it over some bumpy places, because that's where I hear this ooh noise. He didn't say anything. And I was chatting on, you know, I was going to tell him a few things. And then I realized he was listening. So I hushed. And about 3 or 4 blocks later, he said, you don't need to tighten the screw, that rod. He said, that's supposed to be loose. It's a floating power steering. Let it float. And he looked at me again and sort of twisted his mouth, and he said, let it float again. I said, oh. Then I said, you know, like I always do, I keep carrying it on. I said, oh, Smitty, maybe he's tightening it too tight. Maybe that's why that sound. Smitty said, nope, it's all right. It's loose enough. Just don't let anybody fool with it. They don't know what they're doing. So he passed the 7th place, and I pointed up toward my house, and I said, that's where I live. He didn't pay a bit of attention, didn't say, oh, yeah, or anything. He was listening. is listening to that motor. And we got on 8. He said, well, we'll speed her up a little. So he let it out. He went up 8 and down 8 and over some bumps. I don't know how long it was, but I kept quiet while he was listening. Finally, he said, yep, that's it. I bet you got nylon ties. Yep, he said, you got nylon ties. And you know, it really still didn't mean anything to me. He said, that's that sound. He said, you heard it when you first started, but when you got into town, you didn't hear it so much? I said, yeah. Yep, he said, that's nylon tires. And he said, I don't hear anything except for the sort of fan belt noise. And then, you know, he got a rev back in the car as if he'd come to some conclusion. He diagnosed the case. And he enjoyed it. He did. He said, some car. He said, some car. And he turned off 8 and had to put the brake on. And I said, would you put a spring on that brake, Smitty? He said, I ain't got no spring. And I said, sort of, you know, fussing like, I said, well, you can get one. He said, can't get no spring. And then I got to, I'm sure my voice raised a little bit because I was sort of, you know, playing and exasperating. And I said, well, Uncle Johnny said, but he didn't throw off on Uncle Johnny. He never does. He said, this car, Chrysler car like this, don't have no spring to the brake. He said, did you ever try to put your foot under the brake and pull it up? I said, yeah. He said, it won't pull? Has to come up itself? I said, yeah. Spring wouldn't help it. There's no spring for it. Now I think I said, well, you know, it's sort of a nuisance to have it come up the slope. He said, yeah. It might wear your brakes a little bit, he said, not much. They said 4 or 5 years, you might have to replace the whole unit. It won't hurt. No worries. Now he read back and we drove on in and he parked at Gaswell just about the way I did. He got out and I said, well, Smitty, I feel better, thank you. He said, well, when you have any more hearing or more noise, drop by.
Bring it in.
And he grinned. And then he walked on his heels. You know how he does. He walked on his heels with his head thrown back. Last time when I pulled away, he had his head stuck back under the hood. And I'm sure he was away from the place 30 minutes. Good 30 minutes.
Oh, 30 minutes past
the
fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not there with somebody looking at you.
Yeah. And he listened. And I had just about time to go to the house and turn the furnace on before I met Debbie. So I was sort of floating. You know, I had this ride with Smitty and he'd okayed the car.
The car was all right.
And there was a lot full of cars and Smitty had taken time off to do this for me. So I was right cocky. And I told Debbie that I'd meet her at your office. I might not have the car, but I'd meet her. And she wasn't there, and I looked, and I saw this. I didn't recognize it.
You don't have to wind up on that.
Yeah.
Just start in on
Yeah.
That.
And she came on over, and we had lunch in the car. Put our drinks on there. That's a good table.
Oh, you didn't take a sandwich?
No, I didn't take a sandwich because I wasn't sure. And Debbie had an apple, but we got a sandwich over at Crystal.
At Crystal?
Yeah. Well, we got one of those little ones, 18 cents, something like that. And she, one of the things that made me mention the way she was dressed, because I know she can't wear her jeans to the office over there. But, it sort of does something to you, you know, when you have to put on your camper clothes in an office. you're not quite as comfortable in a pair of panty holes and a little dress as you are in a pair of jeans in her outfit. And I think that's true. I think she misses it. You know, she likes the dress. But anyway, we were sitting there in the car eating. She started out on that graduate building. It's like a mausoleum, she said. The building itself is just that it's cold and impersonal, and it is. It's just, she said those four walls were just getting there, and for the first 2 weeks she was over there, she was melodramatic about it at the house. It was just, she didn't know how her family put up with her. And I just listened. She didn't have anybody her own age in her office, just her and Ms. Haynes. Ms. Haynes didn't like to talk. And she said, she just...
Ms. Haynes is broken in, thing.
Yeah, she didn't know, she guessed she should feel lucky that this was, it wasn't just a regular secretary job, it was, had something to it. But she was melodramatic about it, but she's about got her feet on the ground now. And she was ashamed of herself. Because she should have done what God told her all along, is to look at it, inquire, and make the most of it.
Yeah, just look at it.
Just look at it. Yeah, what was, she might find out something. And she said that, but she said, you know, those things I read are so incomprehensible. It's not that I have to know the subject, it's just that they just, it's just trivia, and it's so just, you can't even read a sentence and make any sense out of it. She said she had one light spot that one that was refused, and this boy called her from Tallahassee and said she just ruined his PhD, and he just couldn't, it just was awful. And she said, well, you have to talk to the dean. And she said, you know, I got a sort of a kick out of that he was a fellow there that could explode. And he did. And he did to the dean. But she said that was the most impossible thing she'd ever read. So she said, we do have our light moments. And she said, Ms. Haynes figures that this is a publication. She looks at it as a kind of her publication. And she said, I can look at Ms. Haynes. And it could be I can learn something from these dissertations I read. She said one of them, she said, I can learn something about structure and making statements. And she said a recent one about restoration drama was something that she could learn if she looked at the way it was put together. And it's something, she said, that I can't do. And guy knows it. And I could learn from that. So she says, I got my feet on them, but she said, they're not going to have me long over here. They don't know it, she said. And I thought of cookies.
Yeah. Well, he just sort of humoring himself. He won't have to put up with this forever.
Yeah.
And then sort of playing to you that you won't have to put up with that forever.
Yeah.
And they understand it. It's pretty well, there's some, it's pretty clear, you see, that we're not interested in that.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's but it's the same thing. As
it's that cookie statement.
It's that cookie statement, uh-huh. That, like, you know, when you're standing there at the filling station saying, they think I'm thinking about this station, but I'm not, I'm thinking about something else.
Thinking about horses. They wouldn't realize people coming here wouldn't never think that I was thinking about horses.
That's right. Yeah. And this was the kind of thing with Debbie, and I said to her, when she said that, I said, well, it'd be my notion to get in there and make the most of it. If you're going to have that job, make the most
yeah.
of it. Put
yeah.
your put everything you got in it and make the most of it.
Yeah.
And
while she's over there, show a little muscle.
That's right. And she picked up that word muscle right away. And she said, "I'm not going to be. I am going to be muscular." Well, anyway, this gave me a chance to ask him. If you're talking about it being incomprehensible, I said, well, you know, Daddy, most things that people write, very few, they have an audience.
Very few good readers.
Yes, there's a small audience for anything that's serious. And she said, well, yes, I said, you know, it's, have you found anyone who can read the French experience? It came very naturally. And that's when she said, not really, and she was disappointed that her godmother couldn't read it. In the way that you, that she said, in the way that Guy and I wrote it, or that Guy worked it out, or that we worked it out, she said. And she had written to her godmother about what to look for. And she hoped that when her godmother got down here next month that there could be some talk. Because I think of all the people that she knows, she would like for her godmother to respond to it. And then she said that Nathan was interested, and but he thought that he'd talk with you more than he would with her. And he just asked her what she was going to do with it and thought maybe it ought to be published. Oh, so that was what brought that little. Now that was in my mind to find out from her. And she brought up the about the being muscular way back when we were talking about her working over there and about how she was melodramatic. And I said, you know, Debbie, I'm the one person who ought to know not to use you. And just look what I did to you last Saturday. I said, I told those children when they called and said they couldn't get out here, I said, well, go to your house and come out whenever you were ready. And what happened? You came in and met them and had to wait for them and then offered to take them over to the riding place and then take them back in town. And I got you into it. And she started to stop me when I said at the first, and I know she started to say, well, I wanted to do it. I didn't mind doing it. And I said, yes, I know you don't mind doing it. But you just multiply that by all the friends who use you, and you see what you haven't got any time left to write. She said, yes, I recognize that. And I said, you could very easily have said to the girls, I'm going to leave here at 2 o'clock, and if you want to go with me, you be right here at 2 o'clock. And if they weren't there, just go off and leave them. That's all there was to it. But see, I got you into it, and that's it. And then I think I said, I'm sure I started it, I said, and when they got out there to get the horses, I felt like saying, no, Margaret and Valerie, these are not your horses, they're Debbie's. Debbie's nurse Nuki through her foundling, you know. And that's all I had to say. And she said, you know, when I got back home that night, I just cried. I thought, you know, I felt just like Miles' Christmas. He didn't have a toy. He didn't have a toy to play with, and he said he was not any fun to grow up. And I felt like I ought to be just back sitting out there on that watering trough with Missy. And then I knew that that time was past. I had done too much and seen too much at the ranch for me to be that child again. And I had to be more muscular, and again she used the word. And it gave me a chance then to say, well, when you come out there on Saturday, you've got to have something in your mind to do, unless you just want to lie fallow. Now, I said, Rick said he just had to lie fallow. And she said, I don't want to lie fallow. You know, I didn't say, well, you've been doing it.
Well, you've been doing since
before Christmas. But I said, but I didn't say you've been doing it, but I did say, you know, that little place in the French experience where a guy said he was at a dead end, And you and I both sort of thought, well, we ought to get him to change something. It's a little self-effacing there. People won't understand. I said, you know what he meant? And of course, he still didn't. I said, if he could say he was at a dead end, and his focus, he had been working in it, and that it's difficult, and you do get at a dead end, then the young scholar should admit that there's a dead end every once in a while, or that they misread. I said, you know, it was 3 years before Suzanne ever admitted that she goofed. And it seemed to be a great hurdle that she was over when she finally let out and said, look, I goofed. And I just never understood why she couldn't afford to let herself think she could ever make a mistake.
With me setting them an example all the time, every time I put my foot in my mouth, I said so.
Right, and I said, that's what Guy meant, you know. And when you feel like lying, fella, just say you're going to lie, fella, and nobody will have to guess what you're doing.
Proclaim it.
Announce
it.
Pronounce it, yes. Announce it to the world that you just fed up. And but if you propose to do something, then don't just halfway do it. And now, that gave me a chance to bring up that about the car. And I said, if you want to come out, want to make your rounds, want to write, bring your typewriter, mean business, be vigorous. And I told her about the car, that I didn't want to sell the car, but that it would be available for her. She had put in her name, and then when she got one of her own or went on to something else, she could let me have it done. Well, she thought that would be fine, so that didn't give her any excuse not to come out at her convenience. She wouldn't have to work around her mother. I didn't put any deadline on it and say, now I want to know by a certain time. But this thing of how she'd come out on whenever the weekend was or whenever she came out, I think she said it enough. And when I went back to her also talking about that, and I said, you see what Guy did? He said that Saturday before when you were out here, that you were going good. We were talking about little Bessie, and he got little Bessie up here. And then it took the rest of the afternoon. It's just difficult for us to not direct you, and so you've got to be muscular yourself and show what you're going to do, and don't come out there just willy-nilly. She said that she wanted to bring her typewriter out and work some. And I said, well, that was up to her. So we had I had those little points, those little things I wanted to get out with it. And when she got out of the car to go on back over, she said, now, I won't come out unless I'm got something on my mind. And I will be muscular. She's still like a little girl who learned a lesson. And I said, well, Debbie, that's up to you. But that's the only way that you can come out and expect Guy to help you and work with you. And when you do come out, check with him the first thing so he'll know what's on your mind and won't be just hanging around wondering what you're going to do.
That would be a great relief, Faye.
Just come in and check.
Just come in and be direct about it.
Be direct about it.
If you don't ask me, just tell me.
And you can go ahead about what you're going to do, but then he won't have to hang around. And, you know, I told you, I think, already that we were going ahead just like we always did. Just take a little walk in the back pasture a little bit more, but we were going ahead. We hadn't let up. We weren't lying fallow.
Yeah.
And, it was here, and she said, now I want to write, and I want to write from experience. And I said, well, I heard guys say you could use this material in a number of ways. You know, see what you can do. So she bounced on over toward her mausoleum. And then when she called Friday night, she had this temperature and a sore throat. And she thought she'd better not come out and get it, spread it around. But she was writing, she said, with muscle. She had gone from here. When the girls went down the lane on the horses, Debbie said, now I'll come back and pick you up, take you to your lesson. And I said to Debbie, oh, you don't need to do that. I have to go anyway, so I'll take them. So she went right straight from here then over to Mr. Weaver's. And she said she'd spent the afternoon with Mr. Weaver.
He picked right up. Isn't that amazing?
Uh-huh.
I want to hear what went on for him.
Yeah.
Because you see, when I go there, I run the Flatheads down.
Yeah.
And talk about how much he has done, you see, and he doesn't. It's so fruitless. But there you are again, you see. He doesn't pay much attention to me or things like that that I say. You can't get around it, see. They're all flattered when these Flatheads come around.
Oh, yeah.
I don't care what the Flatheads do or how they act. It's just flattering to them.
Sure is. Why wouldn't it be? Yeah.
No one else pays them any attention.
No one else pays them any attention.
And can listen to them when they talk.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't it be flattering? I'd be flattered too if they'd come around and listen to me.
Yeah.
No, I can teach them how to listen to other people, but I can't teach them how to listen to me.
You see, that's I don't know what sort of spirit Spears has, but when you said, now, let's go out and see these youngsters on the working with these horses.
That's right. He nips at me.
I've seen girls before, you know, I don't know, you know, he's going to set the stage, he's going to, you know, no, just moving along with you.
No, he's not going to move along with you.
He's sort of Florida cracker, whether it's Florida cracker, I don't know what it is, but,
J.R. won't do that.
That's right.
But Spears is the only one, he's, I don't know.
You have to sort of look at him, you know, you can't go around just saying what, people one way or the other. Now he came over here with all that bunch of onions.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't know.
And he has in mind using my old tractor.
Yeah.
Say, what in the world is he going to use my tractor for? All he got is just a little garden plot. He's not going to take my tractor out and hire it out to other people, is he? He wants to put the cultivating equipment on it.
For that little garden plot?
Yeah. All he needs is a rototiller. You know what a rototiller is. Something that you hold in your hand.
Yeah.
Or steer with your hand.
Yeah.
Almost like a, not much more complicated than a power mower, lawnmower.
You suppose he's heard that J.R. bought it?
He knows damn well that J.R. bought it. He knows J.R. got a bad knee. Why did he let on to me that he don't know that? He knows everything that goes on.
Why, you know he does. Said he hadn't seen J.R. in 9 years.
Buses is enough for him. Well, I can appreciate that, but he's not going to get it. I'm going to be using it about that time. When are we going to get this fella Grubb out here, Faye?
Greg?
Greg. Hell, he ought to just come on out here. I mean, JJ ought to bring him.
But JJ said, let him know and he would bring him.
Well, I didn't catch that.
He said, talk it over with John, see if he's interested in anything like that, and let me know, and I'll bring him out.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
You don't have to do that, do you?
Well, I want to put my stuff up, my little thing that I make those comments.